Retort. I'm going to call order. Members, today, as we get closer and closer to, well, you know, I think at 1 o'clock they're releasing the budget targets for committees, which, you know, we're all kind of waiting for to see what the heck happens. So hopefully we will all be happy with the target that this particular committee gets. It'll be, I'm hoping it's a lot different than the last 10 years or 15 years. And because of that particular, pardon? Yeah, well, there's a few of us that have, and it's been going downhill, and we're kind of hoping for a difference in it. So anyhow, we are the Economic Development Committee and Job Workforce Training Committee. And because of that, I wanted to bring in Greater MSP. They are, many of you know who and what they do. They're a regional economic development group. Kind of that does a number of things, and I'll probably miss a few things here. When Mr. Langley comes up, he'll correct me. But you know, their job is to attract and retain businesses, to promote and market us as a region, this metro region, the 14 counties, whatever. And they've been relatively successful. They're not a government organization, they're privately funded. They work with government, but they don't come here asking for money. They don't come here lobbying for anything. They go lobby the department, so we don't get to see them. And so I'm really happy that they're going to come here and give us a little history on what they do, and then kind of their philosophy on economic development. So if I could call Mr. Langley to the witness table, and give us your presentation on Greater MSP and economic development in the region.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for coming to the committee today. I appreciate it. I know your schedule is very busy.
It's absolutely my honor and privilege to be in front of the committee today. I appreciate the opportunity to share some best practices and knowledge and perspective from myself personally about doing this work for 25 years in a number of states and regions. I was recruited to the Minneapolis-St. Paul region almost 3 years ago now. First year I was working as a consultant with the Itasca project and with McKinsey to essentially look at what Minnesota and specifically the Minneapolis-St. Paul region could do and could do better in terms of changing the trajectory of our job growth and new capital investment to create more prosperity for Minnesota and for the Minneapolis-St. Paul region. Coming here from Pennsylvania, where I served as CEO of the Economic Development Partnership in the Pittsburgh region for about 8 years before coming out, being recruited to come here. I also serve on the National Board of Directors of the International Economic Development Council, which is our national association for economic development practitioners and thought leaders. And I'm honored also this year to co-chair the Economic Development Research Partnership, which is essentially a group of thought leaders nationally looking at what best practices in economic development programs are. So it's with that kind of background that we are building with our partners in our region. Our partners include our public sector partners, include certainly the state of Minnesota, specifically Department of Employment and Economic Development as our primary state partner. And then within our region, you mentioned the 13-county MSA, now a 16-county MSA as it was redefined a couple of weeks ago. And so the 14 counties in Minnesota of our metropolitan region, each county and each municipality in those counties we consider our partners. On the private sector side, our corporate partners, our mid-market and small business partners are all investors and participants in the organization. So today I wanted to provide you some information, some facts and figures, and some perspective as we do our work on your behalf, on behalf of the state and the region, and what we believe are some of the key issues that we're facing as a region as it relates to economic development in general, but specifically in terms of our economic development tools and our toolkit that we have to work with in Minnesota relative to other states that we compete against and other regions of the world that we compete against. So the first thing to mention is, as the chair said, we have a mission to attract capital investment and jobs to our region and to the state, and we do that three ways. First of all, with our partners and collectively, make sure that we have a strategy that will work to help our economy grow. In other words, where are we going to compete and how are we going to compete? What industry sectors, what areas of strength in our economy should we be pursuing? Then secondly, once we understand where to compete and how to compete, what are we doing actively in terms of outreach, both on a national scale and a global scale, since the global economy is what we participate in now. And what we know that from our research in the past that the region and the state had not really aggressively competed and told its story aggressively on a national and global scale. So that's raising the amplitude of our voices as a state to ensure that investors and job creators nationally and globally are hearing us and understand what the strengths of our region are and our state are. And then finally, creating the opportunity to bring our partners together and provide a unified face of our region to our clients, to the companies that are looking to maybe invest and create jobs here, versus having each city or county individually addressing an opportunity separately, which is confusing to our clients. What we've heard site selectors and companies tell us nationally and globally is, in the past it's been hard to do business in Minnesota because there were 20 phone calls and 20 different people you had to meet with instead of having a unified organizational structure to help clients make good decisions towards their investments. So that's the reason that we came about 2 years ago. And we've actually about a year and a half doing project work with our partners. As far as the key factors in attraction, retention, and expansion of businesses, decisions that are made by businesses essentially go in this order. First of all, incentives are not the most important decision factor, but they're among one of the top decision factors. Geography and market access and the infrastructure of the state and the region are really the first thing that we deal with. If there's a reason for a company or an investor to see an opportunity in our state, in our region, it's going to be based on their vendor-supplier network, their supply chain, their commodities that they need to make their product or service happen. And so those are the first factors that we engage with the client. And the second, in almost every case, the most important factor after that, if this is a market that they need to do business in, the question is workforce. Do we have the quantity and quality of qualified workers to fuel the growth of their companies and to help them grow and prosper? And so we'll always see workforce as the number one factor beyond the market itself. Business climate, clearly, then it comes next. The overall cost of doing business. It also involves the quality of infrastructure in the business climate. It also involves our tax and regulatory environment. So that's also very important. And next on the list, we believe, comes the willingness of a state or region to induce and encourage business through incentives. Again, not the most important factor, but significantly part of the initial screen. So if we're seen as, these are the four factors that they look at first. So what's the equation in making economic development tools work? First of all, the type of tool, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Secondly, the amount of funding. Thirdly, are they easy to use or not easy to use? So if all three of those factors are positive, then we have an opportunity to attract more capital investment and ultimately jobs in the region. So what are the types of tools that we compete against and we see prevalent not only certainly in our area of the U.S., but nationally and globally. And I would say the basic elements first would be what I would call strategic investment funds. These are also would be classified as closing funds or upfront inducements in many cases. And you can see that the national models that we compete against most often would be programs like the Texas Enterprise Fund, the Florida Qualified Industry Grant Program, Pennsylvania Opportunity Grant, Iowa, Michigan. I can go on and on. There are actually 26 states that key competitive states that we benchmark ourselves against that where we run up against these kinds of strategic investments that states and regions are making in helping companies make a decision to locate or to expand. The second area is strategic development areas. These are specific geographies within regions or states that are induced for investment through specific programs. For many, many years, there have been a lot of programs called Enterprise Zone programs. Those types of programs have been modernized over the years into much more specifically designed programs to induce investment in specific areas that have been either underinvested in or non-invested in because of brownfields issues or other disinvestment issues. Examples of these would be New York, Pennsylvania, and again many other states that specifically target geographies for investment. Workforce innovation programs. Almost every state has a customized job training programs. The difference in those programs is how easy are they to use. And then finally, more and more, because of the global economy that we operate in today, global trade and foreign direct investment is becoming more and more important to economic development organizations and programs on a national scale as we are competing on a much broader landscape than in previous years. So, current incentive toolkit in Minnesota, I would say the primary program that we have for strategic investment funds currently is the Minnesota Investment Fund. It's really the only program that we have today that would fall specifically in that category where there's an opportunity for inducement of capital investment by a company as part of a program. Secondly, strategic development areas. In the metropolitan region, we really don't have any programs that we would classify as strategic development area programs today. When programs are designed on maybe a case-by-case basis where special legislation comes about, could fall into that category, but in terms of having programs on the books that is in statute, we really don't have any programs in the metropolitan area that meet that criteria. In the workforce program area, Minnesota Job Skills Partnership is really the only program that is used on a regular basis today, and we find that it's a great program, but it's very hard to implement. Many companies over the last year have been offered that program as an inducement, and a number of the companies have had to basically turn it down or say we can't use it because of the restrictions that program possesses today. I know that's not the focus of this particular committee, but those workforce programs are going to be very critical to our future success in helping our companies stay here, expand here, and come here from outside the region. And then the global trade and foreign direct investment, we don't have any program currently addressing the specific issues in terms of an incentive program for these areas, but I know there's a proposal on the table by the governor this year to address that. How we compare, this chart is one that we obtained from Jones Lang LaSalle, one of the leading consulting companies that we generally do a lot of work with as they represent companies that are looking for expansion and relocation opportunities. And this chart was used by Jones Lang LaSalle in a national briefing that they did on comparative analysis of states and their incentive programs. As you can see, we didn't fare very well in their analysis where Minnesota and California were the only two states in the poor category for incentives availability. And you can see the other states and how they compare. Another report that I would call out was published by the New York Times by a reporter named Louise Story back in December of last year. She did a five-part story on economic development incentives nationally, and she did a comparative analysis of the cost or spending that states make per capita for tools and programs. And you can see the high was Alaska, close to $1,000 per capita, the U.S. average being about $255, and then Minnesota's ranking was in the lowest five states in terms of per capita spending on economic inducements for economic growth. I mentioned earlier closing funds are a common tool. There are 24 states now that we compete against regularly that have these. Certainly most notably in our area, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois have closing funds of some sort. The largest are generally either in the southeast or in the east. This next piece is very new. We engaged a company, a New York Development Consultants International. They're one of the leading public relations and marketing companies that support both industry sectors and economic development organizations nationally in perception analysis. And so what we asked them to do was to do an independent survey. We didn't want to know who they talked to, but we wanted them to talk to a fairly decent sample size of C-level executives and site location consultants, the folks that actually advise companies on where to make investments and locate. And so they surveyed 150 CEOs and site selectors in the industry sectors that we believe in Minnesota are our key strengths. And these are sectors that both Deed and Greater MSP would agree on that are our areas of strength going forward, like medical and life sciences, food and agribusiness, financial services, advanced manufacturing, and headquarters location and business services. Those would be kind of some of our key industry sectors. And so these C-level executives were asked a number of questions, but one of the key questions on the surface that they were asked is, what are the strengths that you see? What are the most important elements that you see as Minnesota's strengths and weaknesses in terms of its ability to help businesses grow and to be a good place for making investments in business? And so this perception study is just now being published, and this one top line chart shows as you go from left to right what these people that were surveyed considered our strengths as a state and region and what they considered our weaknesses. And then the other axis is from low to high, the importance of that particular criteria in their decision to advise a company to actually make an investment and create jobs in our state. So, for instance, skilled workforce, which you see in the upper right-hand corner, that is considered one of our biggest strengths as a state and a region and something that's very, very important to decision makers to have companies make investments and create jobs here. So clearly, these are areas that we believe are important to stress, that these are areas we want to leverage. And our research university in life sciences is one that this particular cohort really believed was one of our biggest strengths and something that would induce them to help us create jobs in the state. On the other side of the coin, areas that this particular cohort of C-level executives and advisors felt that our state had weakness. And in this particular case, you can see that labor cost a weakness, but not our biggest weakness. Business-friendly government was not considered a strength, and then incentives and tax exemptions was considered one of our biggest weaknesses. Now, remember, these are site location consultants and real estate decision makers, so they really focus on that particular issue, and they felt that was one of our weaknesses. Areas where we have strengths that we can use selectively, as depending on the type of investor that we may be talking to, are our quality of life, certainly. That's very important to some, and it's a significant strength. Good transportation, workforce training programs are considered pretty good. And this particular cohort weren't into manufacturing as much. They were concerned more about life sciences. So they see that as a real strength, our advanced manufacturing R&D, but they didn't really consider it a big decision factor for their particular needs. And then some of our areas that were considered weaknesses, and these are just areas where we would limit our marketing activities. Our utility costs may not be the lowest, but they're certainly competitive. Our utility reliability is very high. And then this particular group was not very favorable on our supplier network, but it's not a significant issue to them. I think that's important to just kind of take a look at. Remember, these are not what we think about ourselves. This is what people that are looking at our state from outside as to what our competitiveness is. So we need to listen and understand what investors and what decision makers are seeing when they see our state. So these are those regional areas of strength that I mentioned. This is where our future is coming from, and so inducing and helping these types of businesses and these sectors grow is certainly what our focus is as an economic development marketing organization for our region and for our state. So the conclusions from this particular work would be that our existing tools are limited and need modernization and revision. And I certainly applaud this committee for its work, and we're very hopeful that your work over the next few months will reap rewards for our state in terms of understanding what our strategy is for our economic development programs, and to design the programs in a way that are going to give us the biggest return on investment as a state, and certainly from my perspective in the metropolitan region. Minnesota's Economic Development Toolkit is currently, in my humble opinion, uncompetitive with most of the states that we're competing against. And real-world experience in this field shows that this does has an impact, a negative impact, on our ability to retain and attract a new trajectory of job growth and capital investment in our state and in our region. So with that, I'm happy to answer questions if you have some. And Mr. Chairman, I'm at your disposal as long as you want to discuss this.
I got one question, and then I'm going to open it up for the others. And you know, one of the things that we do around here is we typically try to ask questions that we have a reasonable idea of where the answer is. And back on, I think it's page 2 or 3, where you have it's 3, where you have the national models, strategic investment funds, strategic development areas.
Yes.
And the Texas Enterprise Fund and the Florida Quality Qualified Industrial Grant. Do you know how much are in those particular funds for those states?
The Texas Enterprise Fund is very large. I've heard you get different numbers, but I know that it was initially funded and capitalized about $200 million. I think right now there's maybe about $120 million in the Texas Enterprise Fund that the current governor and legislature has at their disposal to offer companies that are interested in making big investments in Texas. It's used as a strategic program. It's really not used for very small and, you know, hundreds of deals. It's usually targeted at more larger deals that have a significant investment in job count to the projects.
What about the Florida or the Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I think there are 24 states. The second largest actually is Michigan now. They just approved about $100 million closing fund in Michigan. My experience in Pennsylvania was there's generally about $50 million in that fund that the opportunity grants were based on. The Florida Qualified Industry Grant Program is more in the $30 to $40 million mark, and then Iowa has about a $30 million fund that it uses.
And those others other than Texas, are those one-year, like a biennium kind of funding, or is that?
I think Texas is a biennium. The other states are annual appropriations.
Representative Albright has a question, but we do have other bills, so I'm if I cut you off after a couple, please feel offended, but only offended with me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Langley, on your slide that talks about the incentive spending per capita.
Yes, sir.
And obviously, Minnesota is not Alaska in terms of population. But I'm wondering, in comparison to, say, some state like Colorado, how would how would Minnesota fare compared to Colorado?
I don't have that answer in my head. I can look it up and get you the answer. But I as I recall from memory, we're not too far out of line. I think Colorado had maybe $100 or more per capita. So I'd say maybe twice what we do, but it wasn't up in that $400, $500, $600, or $700 number. But instead of trying to guess, I will be happy to provide you with that number.
And I'm sure you'll share it with the rest of the committee.
Absolutely.
And one more question.
I'll go to the matrix.
Yes, sir.
You know, as I look at this, some other bills that we've heard in this committee, you know, kind of jump to the fore in terms of labor costs, and we're talking about the minimum wage issue, friendly business climate, and the governor has expounded and made some points of taxation on corporations, that type of thing. You know, we've got strengths over here in terms of research, university, life science, and we've got one of our representatives and committee members here with the Destination Medical Center. This is an open-ended question, and I'll leave it, you know, to your discretion. But in your view, either about the strength that we can expand on, or is it more imperative of us to be mindful of our weaknesses and try and improve on them?
Well, that's a great question, and I think that leverage and improve are really the key terms here. In my experience, taking the things that we're really strong at and leveraging those and really spending our money and creating more opportunities in those areas of strength is job one. You know, that's why we actually did about a year's worth of research. Again, McKinsey and company helped us looking at a national view of industry sectors and what industry sectors are likely to grow and prosper and create more jobs and prosperity in the United States over the next 10 years. And we asked them to take that national research and help us drill it down into the state of Minnesota and into the Minneapolis-St. Paul region. And that's where how we ended up with these five areas. So this is where we currently are aiming our marketing focus, is in these key areas of strength, because we know that this is where our highest probability of success will be to create more prosperity and create more jobs. We know that a job in our region, that using a RIMI economic impact study, that using these five industry sectors, that for every family-sustaining, high-skill, high-wage job that is created in our region, that it will create a multiplier effect for 4.1 more jobs, which are generally services jobs, retail jobs, and other family-sustaining jobs in our region. So if we focus, our philosophy is focus our strategy on the key industry sectors of growth, and that from that we'll see a more of a multiplier effect for prosperity throughout our region. So we're going to focus, our philosophy is to focus on our strengths. Clearly, improving our weaknesses has got to be done in parallel. We can't just work on our strengths and not recognize what areas we need to improve as a state and as a region. So, again, that's why I bring this perception study, to show that we need to work on these areas, and whether it's making ourselves more efficient and effective in how we deliver services, or adding programs to the mix that would create some more ROI for us in a better way. So I think it's a little bit of both.
Representative Muller, you got a couple of questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got one question, and I hope the answer is much shorter, just a very quick explanation of why you panned our job skills partnership so badly, because I hear from a lot of businesses that it's a great thing.
Here's my experience over the last year and a half, is that last year out of 31 projects, 18 projects that we worked on with our partners offered that incentive program, and you know, so many of them have not gotten to the point where they're either accepting those benefits or not. It's a wonderful program in that it provides upfront resources quickly, hopefully, to help companies that need either incumbent or new worker training quickly. The issue that other states have solved that we haven't quite solved yet with our program is that today many companies know who their training providers are, have significant needs for that training immediately, and sometimes when you have to go through creating a specific customized program that takes 6 months or more at times, then it's very difficult for the company to take advantage of that benefit. Where many states have modernized their job skills training programs to allow also private training providers in addition to the state-funded, say, MNSCU system that we have here, where the training providers are certified and or provided by our state training through MNSCU. So other states have continued to have those benefits through customized job training, but have also added private training providers who are then approved by the state to provide the training so they can get it more quickly and effectively, and the company can take advantage of those resources more quickly. So that's, you know, one answer would also be that I think we have 16 pages of requirements on our Minnesota Job Skills Partnership. I know South Dakota, they have 2 pages of theirs. So I think there's some simplification and modernization that could maybe streamline the program, make it quicker and more effective. But it's a great program, and I hope we would continue to support it.
So that would be an argument for Governor Dayton's un-session next year, getting rid of extraneous language. If you could pass along some of those states that you thought had does a better job with their job skill partnership than what ours is set up for now, I'd appreciate it.
I'd be happy to
take a look
at
it a little later. Representative Newton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Langley, I have a question also on the matrix in the business-friendly government. And I'm wondering, you know, when we have a vibrant economy with so many Fortune 500 companies, CEOs bringing home $5 to $20 million a year in profits, and yet we have a Chamber of Commerce that cites high taxes, workers not having the skills that they need, the high cost of doing business, and you're on the outside and you're looking at Minnesota as a place to locate, isn't the Chamber really negatively affecting the location of businesses coming to Minnesota?
That could be a loaded question.
Well, I think that I would just respond by saying that these are perceptions. You know, whether it's perception or reality is in the eye of the beholder. And so the 150 CEOs and site selectors that answered this survey had that perception that our government needs to be more business friendly in their mind. Whatever, I don't know what perceptions, how those perceptions were achieved in their minds, whether it was from their experience in doing business here or whether it was some other factor. So I can't address your specific question, but I can say that in this particular cohort of people, that's what they thought. And our job as an economic development marketing organization is to sell our state and our region positively and effectively. And so I can tell you, we're out there talking about what the great things are about our state and our region and the great partnerships we do have with state government, with local government, and with business. So I think, you know, our spin is certainly, we want to see these negative perceptions improve. We want to move those things that are felt as negative perceptions, we want to move those over into strengths, and that's our job.
Thank you. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for coming. It's very enlightening. What do you think the best way we can improve the business climate in Minnesota is getting more investment funds, the most important, or is it getting rid of barriers to growth such as commercial and industrial business, property taxes and high income taxes and things like that? I noticed there's 3 states in the Midwest that are eliminating their income tax this year. What are the things? And then we have a third one. You have certainly regulations and over-regulations. Which is the most important one to get through? Seems to me that we sometime have to look at what we're trying to do, attract businesses from out state, compete with other states for those businesses. What is the number one thing we have to do, number two, and so forth?
Mr. Langley.
I can respond this way and say that it's not either or, and it's not necessarily in rank order. I think it's both and. From my experience, you have to work on these issues in parallel. We should always be looking for more efficient and effective ways of governing and of addressing business issues, whether it's taxes, regulatory environment, infrastructure, you know, roads, bridges, airports, etc. All those things need to be constantly improved. So it's a continuous improvement model for both business climate issues, and at the same time, we need to continue to optimize how we're presenting our product and how we're selling our product. Because if you're making any product, you don't wait till the product gets better to go sell it. I mean, General Mills sells cereal every day. They're constantly improving that cereal, but they're selling cereal every day. They're selling what product they have. So we need to do that. We need to find ways that we can induce companies to invest here and grow here with whatever programs that we can put on the table at the time. At the same time, we need to be working hard, and I know you are, on continually looking at better ways to structure our state taxes, to handle our regulatory issues for business, and to improve our business climate. But I don't think you can say this one comes first and this one comes second. I think we have to do both of those things at the same time.
Members, we have three people that have questions: Kiefer, Norton, and Babian. And we're going to end in about 5 minutes, 6 minutes. So, Representative Kiefer.
I'll be quick. Thanks, Mr. Chair. To the grid also, on labor costs, this, Mr. Langley, would you please just very briefly, on labor costs, it's weak. I want to know, does that mean weak in that we don't pay enough or weak in that we pay too much?
What they're saying here, the survey says that the perception of these decision makers is that our labor costs are very important to their decision criteria, that's one of the first things that they're going to look at. You can see labor cost is very important to them. It's at the top of the chart. And their perception is that our labor costs are slightly higher than they would like to pay. That's the perception that we're getting. Now, it's industry dependent. We have below this data, by industry sector, we know what those perceptions are, whether, you know, maybe in the manufacturing area, our labor costs would have maybe a different perspective. In medical and healthcare, we may have a different factor for what labor costs are felt to be. But overall, they felt that our labor costs were a little bit higher than they see in other regions.
Do you have a follow-up?
Nope, thank you.
Representative
Norton. Well, mine, Mr. Chair, was just meant to be a quick response to what I heard and Representative Albright's comments. And, in fact, this matrix may come with me as we travel along with the Destination Medical Center, because it's exactly the point that we're trying to make with that particular project, is we need to take advantage of the things that we are very good at in the state and in the city of Rochester and in our region, but improve upon the weaknesses that are perceived in our and are real in our state as far as incentives. So appreciating the insights that were shared and just letting you know I appreciate this, and I'll probably steal it from you.
Better be careful, Representative Norton. You might end up, rather than just 16 counties, you might try to make it 17 counties.
Well, I have to say, Gary Smith, who is my counterpart in Rochester, he and I have talked regularly about these kinds of issues. And as Rochester succeeds and is prosperous, then I think our entire state and certainly our metropolitan region will prosper. So I'm, want to do everything we can to help our partners in Rochester succeed.
I think this whole Southeast succeeds if Rochester succeeds. But Representative Babian, a couple of questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe not as much of a question as just a comment. Representative Newton was talking about perception and the chamber and those types of things, and I understand that this matrix is for greater MSP and so forth. I can talk about greater Minnesota, and
sure.
Perception is reality. I have the good fortune to represent an area of the state that has what I like to refer to as the Big Four, and of course this horse is still dead, but I'm going to beat it again. Polaris and Marvin's and Arcticat and DigiKey and plus a whole bunch of other really small businesses. And they're all businesses that have been started by an entrepreneur, you know, going back to the 50s and the 60s, maybe even earlier than that, and they had an idea, and they grew their business, and they had the good fortune to be able to grow and expand. Perception is reality. Every one of those four companies that I've mentioned has had the good fortune to be able to expand and add jobs, and much of that has come outside of the boundaries of the state of Minnesota. Now, whether it's perception, it's reality, this is reality. They have expanded outside of the state of Minnesota. So I believe that we need to take steps to improve Minnesota's economy through making us more competitive, doing things that not only encourage those great companies to expand here, but also attracts businesses. When was the last time we heard of a business in Fargo, North Dakota, relocating in Moorhead? Thank you.
Mr. Langley, you know, I could answer that. You could pass on that, which I would advise you to. You know, but I think you, I'll ask this particular question. How many businesses start and finish, and how many businesses start in the state of Minnesota in a year, and how many go out of business in the state of Minnesota in a year? You may or may not know that. It's data that Deed has, but...
Right. I don't know what the business formation survival rate is over the last year or two, but clearly states and regions that are being successful are seeing higher formation rates and lower and higher survival rates, meaning less failures. And certainly the programs that, as I laid them out, clearly address all four legs of the chair. You know, entrepreneurship is the formation of business and the growth of business from scratch. Retaining and expanding businesses that's something that happens to entrepreneurial startups. We want to retain them here, not after they get their second round of money. We don't want them leaving to go to California. We want them to stay here, and we want them to expand here. Those smaller businesses expand faster at a higher percentage of jobs as they grow than do the large businesses. So those clearly small and medium-sized businesses are the core of our economy.
Mr. Langley, I want to thank you for coming in today. It is always something that we as a committee, we as a legislature should understand. And I will say, you didn't take one side or the other. You really laid it out and said, you know, we've got some issues, we've got some strengths, and I don't think the metro areas weaknesses and strengths are all that much different than the greater Minnesota. There may be a little bit higher on one end and a little lower on the other, but by and large, we're all about somewhat even here. And I'm grateful to see that you've expanded from the original, I think it was 7 or 9 counties, to now you're up to almost 17.
Well, we like to use the metropolitan area as a definition because we have great comparative data between us and other regions of the country, so we like to use that MSA.
Well, thank you. And your contact information is on the back.
Yes, sir.
I do strongly encourage members to have a conversation with Greater MSP, and as I encourage members to call a commissioner in from either any of the two departments that we have, and if you've got questions. Because that's what these people want us to understand. We are not economic development people by trade. We just play it on TV once in a while. And you can give us good advice, and you did today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It was an honor, and I look forward to working with you.
Thank you. Next on the agenda, and I'm going to keep that regional assets of strength. A couple other things. Some members, you should ask for the bubble charts from the Department of Employment and Economic Development someday. Gives you the structure of what our economic strengths and how strong we are and how weak we are in certain areas. Places to look for where we can work to grow our businesses. Next on the agenda is House File 765, the Office of Collaboration and Dispute Management, created in the Bureau of Mediation Services. Representative Lang, how are you doing today?
I'm doing all right with a cold, but I'll be fine. I do have amendment, an author's amendment. The A13.
I should probably pull out the packet here. What is it, the A13 amendment?
Yes.
All right, then. Then this is an author's amendment?
This is an author's amendment, okay. Just changing the language.
Let me move your bill. And where's, are we keeping it here in the committee? Or did
I believe so, keeping it here.
Okay.
So, and I do need to make a slight amendment to the amendment, right. One letter.
Right. Well, let me move your bill first. I'm going to move House File 765 for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Jobs and Economic Development Policy and Finance Committee. And having done that, I will move the 813 amendment and your verbal amendment to the amendment.
And I'll let Ms. Newman speak to that.
Why
don't you grab your mic?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the oral amendment would be on page 2, line 2 of the bill, and it would be to strike the word nonprofits and insert the word nonprofit, just to make it grammatically correct with the amendment.
So, okay. Could you repeat that one more time?
The amendment would be page 2, line 2, delete nonprofits and insert nonprofit.
So it's profits plural?
You're deleting the plural and inserting the singular.
Okay. Has everyone got that? Okay. Okay, so Ms. Newman, do I need to move that amendment prior to the A13?
Mr. Chair, that can be incorporated into the A13 amendment.
Okay. Well, we'll do so. And with that, move the A13 amendment. Are there any questions on the A13 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye. Well, aye. The bill is in the way that you would like it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as you and some of the other committee members here know, for years there's been a hot battle in the legislature over the issue of child custody. Changes, some big, have been made over the years, and yet some people remain furious that these laws have not gone further. Last year, a bill to make big changes moved through the legislature with equal passion, pro and con, and actually got to Dayton's desk. But he vetoed it, saying, "You've got to get together and work out a solution both sides can live with." I always assumed this issue would be a power struggle and whoever had the power would win, the other side would lose. But absolutely amazing to me, 2 months ago, a group of us spent most of a Friday together in a circle, listening to one another, identifying shared principles. We are continuing this process, hoping we can get past the impasse, past the anger, past the fight, to come up with something that will work. And there are hints now of perhaps a judicial solution, a change in how family court handles divorce. To me, this would not only be a deeper and more meaningful result, but a win-win. Well, it's the need today for win-win solutions that drives this bill. Collaboration and dispute resolution can do what polarized politics, angry power brokering, fight to the finish, or even a court battle cannot do. We need these win-win solutions right down home in our own communities, dealing with angry disagreements between neighbors, in tenant-landlord relationships, among our youth, working with our elderly, within our families, even in our churches. If these can be mediated to a win-win, hearts open, lives change. And even beyond that, any new ability to resolve conflicts that the participants may have learned go with them into the next conflict, and there'll always be conflicts, hence benefiting the whole community. But we also need these win-win solutions in larger public policy disagreements like the one I mentioned. Often in these issues, we must have a win-win or we will all lose. For instance, in my hometown of Hibbing, one of the city's three wells has dried up due to Hibbing taconites need to lower the water table in order to dig iron ore. Water, we can't live without it. Jobs, we can't live without them. Can one side just win here? No, this conflict needs to have a solution that serves both, and the DNR has said, don't look at us. This bill refunds an already existent Office of Dispute Resolution within the Bureau of Mediation Services. It's not new government. It's a program within BMS, and this program has two parts. The first part is for the more one-on-one disputes in our communities, with mediation serviced by the 9 already existing nonprofits throughout the state that are certified to do so. But they operate on a shoestring. They utilize trained and committed volunteers, leveraging the small amounts of funding they get. But the need is greater. Many more people could be served. This bill opens grants to these nonprofits. The second part of the bill provides the administrative support for the public policy disputes. The fight over water between an ethanol plant and nearby homeowners and cities, the disagreement between the city, perhaps, of St. Anthony in my district and the Somali community's interest in creating a center, even different perspectives on wolf hunting. Would you hunt a relative? Asked the Ojibwe. The collaborative dispute resolution process can build a consensus solution that lasts. Roger Moe is with us here today. He's the longest serving leader of either body here, 22 years as the Senate Majority Leader. And with that vast experience of legislative action, he will tell you that he thinks this collaborative dispute resolution may be a better way of solving our issues. So I ask your help here. It's always hard to fund something different, something that colors outside the usual lines. But if you want effective, sustainable, quality solutions at both the down-home community level and the larger public policy level, look here. This bill is worth far more than the price. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to start with a short video clip highlighting the community mediation part done by the local nonprofits.
Where's the...
...sees that people can face. When you can get people together to look at an issue and to reach consensus on how they're going to behave together, how they want to be with one another, you can avoid a lot of the problems that plague communities. You have the power to make the decision right here at the table. Lisa, would you like to just start and tell your story?
I don't even know why I'm here. You know, I think this whole thing is hopeless. I called the landlord 3 times and I didn't get a single return call. My children are at risk. They're very important to me. Yet, we're late with the rent. He hauls me into court, never called me. I've never been late before. I think the least he could have done is ask, why am I late?
If you had something that was wrong with your home, and if it's as important to you as you say it is, you should make sure you talk to me before you go out and basically spend my money.
I should be able to lock my front door, keep my children safe.
When you have something that's wrong with your place, you need to let me know. I never got a phone call.
Some of the decisions that have to be made for elders in our community are, where should they live? How can we make sure that they're really taking care of themselves properly? But do it in a way that empowers the older person to be part of the solution.
Who would like to start here?
Why did you bring me here?
I think you know.
You want to change my life. You want to take me away from my home. You want to you want to take me away from my friends that are there.
We don't even want to have to talk about this, but we want you to be safe. You could afford the place that I found.
5 to 7 years.
And it's near you.
In other words, you're telling me that's all the longer I can live.
Dad! We care about you. Don't you get that?
But there's a moment where somebody feels like they've been heard. And the other party may at some point feel like they've been heard. And often I think that's often that moment, that most important piece. It's more important often than the agreement that gets drafted up later.
You never listen to me.
Okay, I'll listen. Talk.
I don't want to talk anymore. All we do is scream at each other.
I'm listening. Start talking. You've got so much potential. You could be a great artist. You're throwing it all away. So what do you want? What do you want, Rachel?
I guess if I come home, then I have to have my own art space. No little rats running through there or whatever.
We could make something. We could rig something up.
we have the potential to step across boundaries and barriers that separate people.
I think mediation is a very powerful process, and what I learned is that I am empowered to resolve issues with another individual.
Mediation helped me get my daughter back. We can touch so many people's lives, and we make the positive and profound and lasting resolution. It's really inspiring.
And with that, I'd like to invite Carmeet Bullman, head of the Conflict Resolution Center, to come down and talk a little bit about the community mediation.
One more tone, Mike.
There's always technical difficulty, all the time. So I'm Carmeet Bullman. I'm the Executive Director of the Conflict Resolution Center. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you so much for having me come talk to you this afternoon. So this gives you a little clip about the importance of investing in community mediation. It basically means leveraging the workforce of thousands of community volunteers to handle cases that otherwise clog our government and our law enforcement entities and courts. Community mediators teach and model and promote important life skills that help people succeed in jobs, in neighborhoods, in families, and in other relationships. Community mediation programs are small entities with a big impact. Usually there are only one or two staff people in these programs, and the funding is needed to coordinate and train the community volunteers to do the work. These nonprofits leverage their other funding sources, and with this relatively small amount of funding that we're asking for, these tiny nonprofit structures can support the volunteers to address crises in employment, housing, neighborhoods, and families. The grants component of this bill will support 9 existing programs, each of whom have anywhere from a quarter-time staff person to 3 staff people. Yet with the help of volunteers, in this past year, we served over 28,000 people. Let me give you an example. In Hennepin County Housing Court, community mediators mediated 6,918 cases in a 5-year period. They had a 79% settlement rate, which means that 5,465 cases did not have to be scheduled for trial, and each trial requires a judicial officer and court staffing expense that must be funded by the state. These cases were settled quickly, effectively, and inexpensively without the need for state government expense. According to a Massachusetts legislative study, for every dollar spent, there is $4.48 return on state investment through resources leveraged. Also, a study in Maryland found that each time a citizen calls the police, the city incurs a cost of anywhere from $24 to $194. When mediation is used as an alternative to police involvement, cities save this amount. So here's our problem. Minnesota underutilizes this cost-effective public service. This is especially true in greater Minnesota, where regional disparity in the quantity and quality of service is a significant issue. The states that most effectively take advantage of alternative dispute resolution have a statewide office that increases and enhances alternative dispute resolution in the state and allocates grants to community mediation centers. Minnesota's statewide Office of Dispute Resolution has been defunded since the early 2000s. Additionally, Minnesota lags behind other states in funding ADR. In particular, state funding for community dispute resolution lags behind, whereas similar-sized states such as Oregon and Maryland receive over $1 million. In Minnesota, 9 community mediation programs split $99,000. So this bill is the solution. 70% would be allocated to the community dispute resolution programs across the state, and we serve our communities, our employers, our courts, our schools, local government agencies. 30% Roger Moe will talk about later, and Josh Tilson, the commissioner of the Bureau of Mediation Services, will go to fund the program with BMS, the state office. So we are asking you here to please consider funding this for many reasons. But I'm going to ask now for one of our volunteers, Janet Collins, to come in. She is one of our many dedicated volunteers to talk about why this is a good expense and why she spends her time volunteering for the Conflict Resolution Center.
Hi there. I'm Janet Collins, and I've been volunteering and mediating for community mediation programs for about 10 years. This is incredibly important and impactful work. I work with people, well, it could be employers and employees, it could be two different businesses, it could be high school students, it could be neighbors, it could be a variety of things. I work in harassment court. So regardless of the type of case, people come in very angry. Quite often they're sad, usually vulnerable, often confused, and usually quite self-absorbed. We are not at our best when we are in conflict. So I sit down with these people, and I don't judge their circumstances. I don't judge their behavior. I help them have a much more productive conversation than they can have on their own. So what I do is I sit down and I help people listen to each other. Once people really, truly get listened to, they calm down. They feel calmer. They feel more clear. And they can make better decisions on their own behalf. And they are more likely to look outside of themselves and be able to see somebody else's position. I watch people go from viewing each other as evil and monsters to seeing each other as human again. And it's really the key to successful mediation. We're not there asking people to calm down and telling them to not interrupt each other. This is a very intense way of being with people. It's an honor for me to do this work. It's an honor for me to be able to volunteer. I intend to do it for as long as I can. I support the bill, and I think it's an incredible gift that we give.
Thank you. Were you, Representative Lang, did you have...
And Roger Moe would like to come down.
Well, I have about four more minutes.
Okay.
So
he can speak to the other part of the bill, which is very important.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the House Jobs and Economic Development Committee, my name is Roger Moe, and I'm here as a citizen, as a former colleague of some of yours,
you were a senator,
and it's with a certain amount of fear that a former senator sits before a House committee. I want you to know that, but I believe deeply in this process, and if I can just share with you just a little bit of my history. About 15 years ago, I was asked to join a national nonprofit board called the Policy Consensus Initiative. And it's the chairs have been ex-governors, and it's a combination of some ex-legislators, some incumbent legislators, some practitioners in this field. And from that experience, I learned a lot. And I learned... that there's a lot of different ways to resolve differences, and I would dare say that I don't mean to speak for all of you here, but I'm going to guess that whether you've been here a year or 30 years, there's sometime in that process you have looked at that bill and said to yourself, "Why is this thing before us?" And what we're talking about here is a way to keep things, not that this is a bad arena, but to keep things out of this arena or out of the courts, to resolve these things by basically getting people together. One of the ideas that, I have to confess something, as a legislator, I didn't have very many original ideas. I just stole them from wherever I could find them, And an idea that I came across while I was while I've been on this board is a program that was started in Oregon called Oregon Solutions. And it's a way, the governor uses it as a way to help solve issues without having it end up in the legislature or end up in the courts by involving people. And so I bounced this idea off some of the fellows at the Humphrey Institute, and so hopefully someday we might have a Minnesota Solutions, because I think it's a way for people to sit down together to try to reach a goal. And the solution, if you set a goal and you can reach that goal, whatever it is, whether you can resolve differences or set out a roadmap to some solution of some problem, it seems to me that that has standing. And it has a lasting standing. It's not going to be overturned because everybody has buy-in and is a part of this, has buy-in on the solution. And so I've become a strong supporter of this collaborative governance, collaborative problem solving, and I think it's the sort of tool that we should use more of in this state. I realize the situations that were featured in the film are a little more personal. I tend to think that where you would see it more often would be things in the natural resource, transportation, growth areas that you confront. But I'm a firm believer of this. I think I would encourage you to go to YouTube and type in Policy Consensus Initiative, and you'll see a number of different situations where legislators around the country have used this this process. And anyway, with that, I would I realize you have limited resources, but this would be a good investment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Moe.
Well, we do have Josh Tilson here, the commissioner of BMS. He could come down and you could ask any questions, perhaps.
Mr. Tilson, tell me. Mr. Tillman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thanks for having me here again. I'm Josh Tilson. We've met before. I'm the commissioner of BMS, and I'm not going to take up a whole bunch of your time this morning, this afternoon. Basically, what I want to say is BMS supports this initiative. We've done this kind of work in the past. I think that there's a little bit, because there's so limited time, I think it's important to understand that there are two parts of this. The part that Senator Moe talked about, which is really aimed at public policy and intergovernmental and government-citizen disputes, and the civil or community mediation grant program. And we've linked them together for a reason, because we think that resolving community mediation disputes is important, and it's a cost-saving measure for Minnesota. And the public policy dispute resolution is something that needs to get bootstrapped. We've been trying to get it bootstrapped for a while. BMS does these kinds of things when it can now with the resources that it has available, but we can't do much of it. And so that's why we think this is important. With that, I can give you a bunch more on what we've done in the past. I have lots of examples of kinds of cases that we've worked on, including for those of you that want to save money in state government and state and local government, we've spent quite a bit of time assisting and local units.
I'm going to stop you right there because
sorry.
I think I now have like five people that want to ask a question. And you've all got right. 3 minutes. So,
sorry.
Representative Ward, you ask first.
Okay, Mr. Chair, it's not a question, just a comment. And I two members, I'm a co-author on this bill. I support it strongly. And let me tell you why. I was an emotional behavior disorder teacher. Well, I was that, but I was also taught emotional behavior disorder in children in my career. And you know, I've been through the training of conflict resolution and dispute resolution. And you know, members, it really, really does work. It really does work, and it is effective and efficient, and it's something that we should look at more closely here. That's all I have to say, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would also like to say I support this bill. I believe in mediation. I really do. Keeping things out of court, you know, attorneys are $400 an hour nowadays, and a lot of people simply don't have that kind of money. But by keeping this out of court, you know, there is a good return on investment here. There really is, and some amount was said $1 spent, $4.48 return. Well, return on investment like that makes good sense to me. There's just one thing that I would like to perhaps ask Mr. Tilson is this bill says 70% must be used for grants, 30% for overhead. And that really does seem a little high on the overhead for me. I'd like to see us get more bang for the buck out of that. And I've really never seen too many organizations that can't operate on 25% or less.
Wait a minute.
Well, my question is, could it be done that way? For Representative Lane, could we at least take a look at that? Where did that number, that 30% come from?
Representative Lane.
Mr. Chair, that's not 30% overhead. That's 30% for the other half of the program. One half of the program is the grants to the local community mediation, as you saw in the film, and the other 30% is to the public policy kind of work that Roger Moe was speaking of. So it's two parts to the bill. It supports the public policy and it supports the community mediation.
Okay, well that clears it up very good for me. I think that's that will work then.
Thank you. Quickly, I have Mehta and Leidiger are two people. Norton wanted a question, but I'm probably not going to get to that. So if you have a quick question.
More of a comment as well in support. Okay. So,
Representative Leidiger.
Leave it there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Take care of Hibbing, please.
My comment, mine I think is just going to be a comment. You know, I support mediation services for all the reasons that we've discussed. The problem I have is that we tend to want to create more government, statewide government, in order to manage this when we can take that same amount of money and have it go directly to the organizations. I'm seeing a lot of this, that what we do. We create these agencies or small sub-agencies that are floating around within the larger agencies, and I think it's something that we need to streamline and do a little bit smarter. Take the dollars that we would do to create these things, and I'm seeing this not only in jobs, but we're doing this in other areas. Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
The 70% of what they're asking for here, which is 75%, goes direct grants to small agencies, local agencies, and the other 30%. I'm not sure where that goes just yet.
I think, and so really what I'm talking about is that other 30%, then get it all over. We don't need to create something in state government. There's got to be a better way of doing it.
Representative Norton, you have a question, and then we're done.
Yeah, to this point, I was part of the group that pulled with Representative Mahoney and others, that pulled this group together that was referenced at the very beginning. And we have had to beg, borrow, and steal to get money, and we don't have enough to finish the process because there isn't anything in state law for us to do it. The governor recommended mediation. There wasn't a place for us to go to do what we needed to do, as you heard from Roger Moe just a moment ago. So this is setting in process something that we can use. And frankly, as I look at what we're doing in licensing for Health and Human Service, in many of the bills that are traveling this year and that traveled for the last 2 years are highly conflictual issues that could better be handled in a different forum and then that solution brought to us for final debate. And that's what this is trying to do. So I strongly support it. I think, you know, we're not through with the process that we started. I think if we can through with the process that we started, I think if we can continue on, we'll see good results.
No, we're not through. And with that, I'm going to lay this bill over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Enterprise Minnesota, please come on down. Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. I would like to move House File 1018 for possible inclusion in the Jobs Omnibus Bill. Is that correct, Mr. Chair?
That would be correct.
So, members,
I just want to know how you got my favorite bill.
I'm very lucky, Mr. Chair, just very lucky. So, Mr. Chair, members, I just want to briefly describe for you what This bill is all about House File 1018. It's Minnesota's Growth Acceleration Program, and I've got some testifiers here with me, Mr. Chair, that can enhance on the testimony that I'm about to give you. But it's a $3 million appropriation over the biennium for grants to basically for Enterprise Minnesota to help with our manufacturing base in the state of Minnesota. Members, let me just give you some, you know, some clarification of the whole GAP program, the Minnesota Growth Acceleration Program. 5 years ago, Enterprise Minnesota advocated for and secured the Growth Accelerator Program, which is known as GAP, a statewide matching investment that enables small and medium-sized manufacturing companies to access business improvement services. These direct investments led to, members, job creation, job retention, and future business growth, and fuel Enterprise's mantra of helping manufacture enterprises grow profitably. Here's the GAP company results. Since its inception in 2008, GAP has fueled over 245 Minnesota manufacturing companies to invest in their respective organizations. As a result, these manufacturers have created and retained, members, 1,700 jobs in Minnesota, boosted company sales by $106 million, saved these companies almost $16 million in business costs, and on the average generated a $30 to $1 return on investment, and some companies have experienced a $40, members, to $1 return. In my own area, members, two companies that have used this program, Stern's company in Baxter, where they have 180 employees, have used this program to expand their company's base. And also Pequot Tool up in Pequot Lakes with 73 employees have also used this program to expand. And I have toured Pequot Tool. I'm going to tour Stern's during Easter break. Just a couple other quick things, and I'm going to turn over to my other testifier if she wants to fill in anything that I left out. In order to be eligible for GAP, companies must be located in Minnesota. They are a manufacturer or a related business, operate as an independent profit center, employ 250 or fewer full-time employees, must have a business plan for improvements, and demonstrate an economic need for the growth acceleration program. All companies awarded GAP resources must match at least $1 for every dollar of GAP investment. So, you know, that's very, very critical important. The need for the $3 million appropriation. The company demand for GAP is outstripping the current available funding. This results-driven investment, authorized by the Minnesota legislature with a one-time funding in 2007 and 9 and again in 11, is administered by Enterprise Minnesota and Deed with its fiscal agent. Members, I will just conclude there and turn it over to my testifier, and we'll be here to answer any questions.
And Mr. Ward, just so you know, everyone, there are certain ways to get to a chairman's... never mind. You don't look like Louie.
No, I don't.
Please introduce yourself to the committee.
I'm lucky. Members of the committee.
actually you are.
Representative Mahoney and Representative Ward, members of the committee. My name is Lynn Shelton, and I'm the Director of Marketing and Communications for Enterprise Minnesota. And you may recall about a month ago, our President and CEO, Bob Kill, was here to testify before you about the value of the Growth Acceleration Program. And as Chairman Mahoney has articulated, there's an article in next week's edition of Enterprise Minnesota Magazine that highlights his opinions about the value of manufacturing as a job-creating engine in the state, as well as a feature piece about GAP and the three testifiers that we had last time, all manufacturing companies who contribute greatly to the value of our economy. I'm just pleased to echo what Representative Ward said about the value of the Growth Acceleration Program. We endorse this request for a $3 million investment from the general fund for the 2014-15 biennium. And as you weigh important funding decisions this session, please also know that GAP is also an important component in bolstering a federal investment from the U.S. Department of Commerce that leverages leverages these federal dollars, and it's called NIST-MEP, the Manufacturing Extension Partnership. So this cooperative agreement works solely for the benefit of smaller manufacturing companies for the creation of jobs and the growth of manufacturing businesses in our state. So again, on behalf of Enterprise Minnesota and Louis Jamboy, we did submit his testimony for the record today. So if there are any questions, I'll attempt to answer them.
No, before we get started on any questions, I will say that I know there is a move afoot to, you know, the President Obama in his State of the Union, and in a year or two before, he put together a number of initiatives on advanced manufacturing. And have you been dealing or participating in any discussions about that around the state or and at the federal level, trying to get one of those particular advanced manufacturing laboratories here in the state?
I do know that there are discussions going on within the state of Minnesota to that effect, Chairman Mahoney. And clearly, we are one of 60 affiliates around the nation that acts as what they call a center out of the Department of Commerce's Manufacturing Extension Partnership. And they particularly are engaged at the state level in those types of conversations. So, yes.
Are there any other questions for the testifiers? Testify. I'll ask this one then. Is there if we put your bill together, if we put our bill together at $3 million, is there a difference in what the federal government matches, or is it a match, or is it a 1-to-1 match? Is it a 1-to-5 match? Or
it's a 1-to-3 match. So for every dollar that we draw down, we obtain 3 from the federal level.
So then your budget, if you were given the $3 million, you would actually, in state general funds, it would make for a $12 million pot to work with companies in the state.
I apologize. No, that would not be the case. We have a federal investment of $2 million from the NIST-MEP partnership. What your investment does is leverage our ability to utilize those federal dollars because we are able to work with more companies ourselves.
Okay, okay. Well, what is your total budget in a year then?
I'm sorry.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. The total budget for Enterprise Minnesota in a biennium, or this is a $1.5 million in a year?
That's correct.
And what's your total budget with matching grants? And
for Enterprise Minnesota, our total budget is approximately $4 million.
Thank you. Well, seeing no other questions, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Members, I think that takes care of us for the day. We have a big agenda on Thursday. There's like 10 bills to get done, a couple of amendments. Remember, amendments are supposed to be in by noon tomorrow for anything on Thursday. And with that, we're done. Thank you.